Hello, everybody, and welcome to Media Voices, the media-focused podcast that brings you all the news and the views from around the media world. I'm Chris Sutcliffe.
I'm Esther Thorpe.
And I'm Peter Houston.
And it is less than 3 weeks to go to get your entries in for the Publisher Podcast Awards. Esther, how would people go about doing that?
So you go to the website at publisherpodcastawards.com. You download an entry pack and we will then send you reminders every week. So it's literally as simple as that.
Easy.
So, Peter, who did you talk to this week?
This week I spoke to Asaf Peled from Minute Media. The company started in Israel but is now global. Sports fans will know them for 90 Minutes, 12 Up and maybe the esports site DBL Tap. But I was intrigued to talk to them about their acquisition of one of my favourites, Mental Floss.
You know how sometimes we'll have a week where not much happens and we actually struggle to find stuff to talk about? This isn't one of those weeks. To begin with, Twitter has banned all political ads on its platform. So Jack Dorsey probably sticks to his back teeth of bad press about Twitter's continued inability to deal with trolls and abuse, decided to shift the focus back onto poor, beleaguered Mark Zuckerberg by stating that Twitter will no longer accept political ads on the platform. This comes after Facebook had some controversy when they stated that political ads that contained untruths are just something that we're going to have to learn to live with. So on the face of it, this is a big PR win for Twitter. But is it?
I'm quite curious as to why this has all suddenly come up now.
I guess because it's the start of the election cycle in the States.
But I mean, have they spent the last 4 years trying to figure out how to deal with this?
Yeah, of course they have. They've had thousands of people working on it. Thousands.
Well, I mean, the reality is that, as we said later on in these notes, the reality is that you cannot vet political advertising effectively. There's an opinion piece on the NYT from Siva Vaidhyanathan, who's professor of media studies at the University of Virginia, who basically points out that the sheer scale of political ads globally appearing on Facebook alone means that you could never, you know, adequately vet them all. I mean, the amount of time-sensitive work that goes into it and the amount of mistakes that would inevitably be made basically means that you just can't vet political ads. In the UK, we've never even tried. You know, political ads can run without checking, effectively.
That's not quite true. If you run them on print or TV or anything else, they do have to fall under the Advertising Standards Authority guidelines, and that does include truths and untruths.
And another issue is that the ban also applies to political issues, quote-unquote, including climate change. So what counts as a political issue and what isn't? Or is this going to be like our Brexit-free Sky News channel again, where you can't do it because it touches everything?
I'm not suggesting this, but that's the only way you can sort this, is have no political ads anywhere.
And I think Dorsey's...
Discuss.
Dorsey's thread on this is quite interesting because he said that basically the principle behind what they've decided to do is that he thinks that the reach of political messages should be earned, not bought. And he kind of said in this thread that the internet political ads have basically completely changed civic discourse because you can... he was saying that people are like machine learning, optimising the messages. There's been huge issues with micro-targeting on Facebook and Twitter over the last couple of years, and you just can't check the information. Some people have also said that if people want to amplify their messages artificially, they can just basically use bots and that it is still open to exploitation.
But the whole system's open to exploitation. That's a problem with it. Even if it's not ads, then disinformation is being spread within groups and outside of groups and by individuals. And I think the other side of this issue is the fact that it's actually not worth an awful lot of money.
Well, relatively.
Yeah, relatively.
It's a lot of money for me. Like if I were to. But yeah, so, I mean, Facebook said that political advertising spend on its platform accounted for less than 5% of all total ad spend. I can't imagine that even given Twitter's slightly more discussion-focused approach.
Well, I saw this. One of the things I saw written about this was that Facebook's a place where you go if you want to change someone's mind. Twitter's a place you go if you want to try and get people to set the news agenda.
Yeah.
Described it as the place that the chattering classes like us would be.
But I mean, a lot of people have said that this is a PR win for Twitter, but actually, in a way, Zuckerberg himself has said that actually he's now taking that chance to be like the stand for free speech and... You know, you can say whatever you want on our platform, we won't stop you.
In a libertarian head case, right wing nut job sort of.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
So that's playing to the kind of Republican side because, and you know, I don't know where they find these people, but Trump's 2020 campaign manager said that Twitter's move It was another attempt to silence conservatives because Twitter knows Trump has the most sophisticated online program ever known.
There is no way that Trump has the most sophisticated online program ever known.
If his wall was anything to go by with people getting through the kitchen scissors or something.
But given how much he is amplified on Twitter, does Trump need political advertising on Twitter, given that anything he says seems to...
He's spending
anyway?
A lot of money, though.
Yeah.
Maybe not Twitter so much, but he's spending shitloads of money on Facebook. Was this $15 million already or something?
Yeah.
I don't. You know what? The bottom line is the whole thing, Twitter, Facebook, whatever, is
Okay, so Nick Thompson was saying this on Twitter this week. Is there a middle road between outright ban and complete free speech on ads on social media?
You know, I remember the good old days when there was a presidential campaign or a UK general election. And media people used to get excited because it meant that their budgets would go up for that year. And now it's just like, oh my God, it's just Armageddon.
All right, so how about this then? As a sort of final question on this, do we think that Twitter banning all political ads is going to improve the online political ad landscape even slightly, or is this
on
something...
Twitter? Yeah.
Yeah.
Not anywhere else.
It depends if it eventually forces places like Facebook to back down, which don't think it will
happen. Have a word with yourself.
Yeah.
That's not happening.
Moving on then, Future PLC is acquiring TI Media for £140 million sterling. What's been the sort of lead up to this? Because it wasn't that long ago that, as it was then, Time Inc. UK changed hands.
Well, it was back in... It's actually February last year. Epirus, who are a private equity firm, bought Time Inc. from... Was it Meredith? I think it was Meredith, just after Meredith acquired the whole group, for £130 million back in February last year. But since then, Epirus have kind of... It's been a lot of cutting...
What does this mean for Future?
Well, it makes Future the biggest European publishing group.
Yeah, by some distance as well.
I mean, it kind of doubles, it's more than doubles their revenues. Mm. And this is an interesting one because on the face of it, it seems like a win-win-win.
Yeah.
You know, is it Epirus or Epirus or Epirus?
The big E, I'm going to call them.
The big E. Bought this for a certain amount of money and sold it for more money. That's a win. Future's bought a business where there's a couple of add-on parts, like the distribution business, that they could maybe sell and get their money back. So I guess the losers is going to be, as always, the people that lose their jobs.
But that hasn't really happened that much. Because, I mean, Future's been acquiring quite heavily for the last 2 years. There haven't been that many job losses so far.
Yeah, but this business is, I think, part of what the VC people were doing was already starting to cut.
Mm.
There's a brilliant piece, as always, Colin Morrison's Flashes and Flames on this. It's just insane. It's like a PhD thesis in a couple of thousand words on Future acquiring this business. It's just brilliant. But one of the things that he says is that TI Media is very... There's a lot of administrative staff. And he's basically saying in that piece that that could be a real target.
But what does do for their media portfolio? You know, what is this adding to Future's existing stock of magazine titles and online brands and all this kind of stuff?
I think it's adding three completely new verticals for Future, isn't it?
Yeah.
I think it's lifestyle, women's interest and sport. Which
TV,
are kind of areas that they've not had, yeah.
And TV listings.
Yeah, TV listings is it's bizarre to me, isn't it?
Yeah. It's a huge sector.
I know, but how?
I don't know.
How? It's got to be slower to flick through a print title to find the TV listings than just going on to the EPG.
Slow's not always worse, Chris.
It can't include things like what's appearing on Netflix or like...
No, they do. A lot of them do.
Okay. But that's
not,
already
not
on
necessarily
Netflix.
What's appearing on Netflix, because you couldn't have a TV list, a print listing like that.
Yeah, but just like what's coming, what's going, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. What's new, what's releases.
The only... But
I don't know.
Netflix already includes that. If you're like, why is the... Anyway. But yeah,
Chris's brain explodes.
I just can't believe that one. But TI Media's portfolio includes exactly what you said, and it seems like this will actually give Future more opportunity to broaden the stuff they're doing around events and e-commerce.
In a broader sense, is the turnaround of Future.
Mm.
No, they looked shaky for a while.
I was going to say, even 5 years ago, they were on dicey ground.
I worked with Team Rock, who bought Future's music titles, I don't know when that would be, 2014. And I remember them moving out of those offices in Balcombe Street, and that was really depressing.
Yeah.
And then now they're back. We're back. From an industry point of view, consolidation is inevitable, so at least the consolidation here is happening with a company that seems to have its finger on the...
Is that the first all-round good story we've had all year?
It's the first one I remember seeing. All-round good story, guys.
We've had some magazine launches and stuff that have been good.
That's true.
So now for the news in brief. Netflix is to launch its first original podcast in partnership with Spotify. Now listen carefully to the next bit because I'm only going to say it once. The podcast will tell a story of when a group of teens decide to make a podcast during an apocalypse.
Yeah, because that's the first thing you would want to do, isn't it? Never mind building that shelter. Get the podcast equipment out. Talking to Spotify, the company is launching a new app called Spotify Kids to provide a safe space for kids to listen to music and podcasts.
It's basically like they'll make sure like no explicit stuff gets in there so people can't listen to us.
Me.
Well, see, this, you're costing us the lucrative kids audience, Peter.
Oh, sorry.
All those kids who want to get into business analysis.
I'm honestly surprised it's taken them this long to do this.
Yeah. Moving on, Stylist Group has joined the Ozone Project, which is a media audience network formed last year with the explicit aim of challenging Google and Facebook, talking of David and Goliath. Ozone claims to reach 99% of the UK's online population.
Doesn't that sound like a Bleach advert?
Yeah.
Ozone claims to kill 99% of Google and Facebook's reach with the UK population.
You can see it going around the inside of the toilet bowl in your mind.
Yeah, exactly.
Wow.
Oh, dear. Choppy waters at Deadspin. Are we talking... Who to be at Meg...
Megan Greenwell, who quit a few months ago.
Megan Greenwell, about this. So anyway, Deadspin, bunch of people are bailing from Deadspin because they were given a stick to sports order by the new owners.
Yeah, it was slightly more than that, actually. Effectively, a few of them were giving their marching orders for this, and then a lot of them have resigned in solidarity.
Yeah, that business is just goes from crisis to crisis.
It was also slightly in protest about how some ads were being run. So just very poor mismanagement.
I think if you're making decisions that cause your entire editorial staff to quit, you need to have a good hard look at yourself.
Amen.
Apple TV Plus has launched. We're going to have to, I guess, circle back around on that because I haven't seen any of it. But Esther, are you excited for Disney's Star Wars The Mandalorian, which is launching on its own streaming service soon?
When do we actually get Disney Plus in the UK?
I have no idea.
In the Google versus EU publishers debate, French publishers have backed down this week.
Oh, merde.
On enforcing the snippet tax after Google threatened to leave search results blank. But French media have actually filed a formal complaint to the French antitrust body, arguing that Google have put them in an impossible position. So this will probably go nowhere, but it's interesting. It's going to be interesting to see what Google actually kind of responds to this now.
Okay, Peter, I'm going to describe somebody to you in a single sentence, okay. And I want you to tell me who I'm talking about.
Here we go.
Desperate for attention, racist, who has been given a platform they had no entitlement to in order to generate revenue for a media company. Who am I talking
Farage
about?
Farage Trump.
Wow.
Casey Hopkins.
This week, it could be any of those people, but this week, I think it's probably you're describing Rod Little.
I am, yeah. And so he ran, an article ran in The Spectator this week.
Loosely speaking.
Yeah, an article opinion piece ran in The Spectator, which contained a number of jabs at, a lot of people, but including some fairly racist language aimed at Muslims.
But let's remember, behind every opinion article, there is an editor who lets it run.
Exactly.
But for something else, I didn't apologise, but you kind of rode back a little bit.
He did. Yeah, he said the article should not have run as is, but he wouldn't have run it at all if it were genuinely racist and not just lighthearted jabs.
Oh, so it's accidentally racist.
Oh, yeah, no, it's either, well, he's either saying he's incompetent as an editor for not understanding the context of this, or he's saying, well, in fact, that is what he's saying, because he's not going to say tacitly, we need the revenue that Rod Little's, you know, outrage engine generates for us. And there's a fantastic article from friend of the Media Voices, Jasper Jackson, in New Statesman, basically arguing that point at length, that there is a controversy revenue, you know, potential for every newspaper now, and it's just that The Spectator got it spectacularly wrong with this one.
It was awful. I read it. It was awful. Anyway, talking about psychotic...
Racists of the week.
...media coverage. Steve Bannon apparently is eyeing up the Telegraph.
As if he's ever going to go through with it.
But actually... Steve Bannon and the Telegraph audience would probably get along. What were we saying about that one, guys?
Never going to happen.
There you go.
Let's hope we don't have to row back on that in a couple of weeks.
It's fine. I can go back. You know how you can replace the audio on SoundCloud? I'll just go back into it and just change it.
See, Steve Bannon has bought the Telegraph, just like we always
said. As we always said it would.
Could we go back and edit 120 episodes?
I have been doing.
This week's interview is with Asaf Peled, founder and CEO of Minute Media. We spoke about the importance of community to his brands, making well-loved print brands work digitally, and the outlook for digital media more generally. But I started by asking him about the Israeli roots of Minute Media.
We started the company about 8 years ago in Tel Aviv by a couple of founders. Back then, we're very, very passionate about sports. However, Israel is a fairly mediocre sports and media market. So our only way to get into the business was to use the fact that Israel is a kind of technology hub. And so we were trying to look for ways to combine our passion for sports and technology and build a global publishing platform focusing on sports. When we started Minute Media 8 years ago, we were operating under the name 90min, which stands for our global football publishing brands. And there were three drivers or preliminary ideas behind 90min when we started it. One was the fact that we believed back in 2011 that the way to create interesting, engaging, authentic content in football would be through engaging the fans rather than more traditional journalists. So that was kind of bet number one for us. We have created a product that invites fans and allows them to create very rich content covering sports. The other kind of the second driver was, again, the use of technology. So looking at it to football publishing back then, we're quite stunned by the fact that all our competitors were very traditional websites, not using technology. And we thought that with the passion and engagement and the level of enthusiasm that you see around sports, we could really leverage technology. And so that was driver number two. And then with the fans and that technology, we thought that we could become a very global player from day one in a space that back then, 8 years ago, was very local. So all our competitors are still very local publishers. But again, the use of technology and the fans have allowed us to go global from day one. So that was the idea behind 90min 8 years ago. And for the first 4 or 5 years of the business, we had focused on trying to turn 90min into the top global football publishing brand on the internet. And we have, for the most part, managed to do so. After 4 or 5 years, 90min has grown significantly and has become a major player in digital football across 14 different football markets in Latin America, in Asia, in Europe, in the US. And then back in 2016, we decided to replicate the 90-minute experience and launch our second publishing brand called 12UP into the U.S. market. And in the U.S., we decided to focus on NBA, NFL, MLB, but essentially leveraging the same fundamental drivers that have been enabling the success of 90 Min, which is, again, creating content by fans, using our technology platform, and the scale around that. So 12UP has succeeded quite rapidly and quickly in the U.S., and with the success of 12UP and 90 Min, we then decided to replicate the model and launch our third publishing brand in DoubleTap, which is in the esports space. And then over the last couple of years, we made another decision, which is realizing that the technology, the publishing technology that we have built and powers our business, can also enable other publishers, other big media companies that may lack the in-house technology know-how that we have built over time. And so we have decided to open our technology platform up and invite other publishers to use that technology on their sites. So that has really grown significantly over the last 3 years. And now, fast forward into 2019, we have about 35 big publishers, media companies using our technology platform.
And is that primarily for user-generated content? Are they using your technology to get their, whatever their version of the fan community is involved?
Yeah, great question. So the first few partners or customers are using it for user-generated content. However, we have enhanced and diversified the technology and the kind of the content formats and experiences. And now some partners actually use the platform for more traditional or more professional journalism as well.
What's the difficulties in managing what's fundamentally a technology company alongside a publishing company?
I'm still amazed on a daily basis by how different the two sides of the business are. Mm. So if you look into the kind of the publishing industry, you do find very, very few technology companies out there. 99% of the companies in publishing are non-tech companies.
Yeah.
So that starts with the DNA of the founders, of the early investors, of what people are passionate about, which is content. It's advertising, it's media. You see publishing companies start in the publishing hubs, in the media markets, as in New York and in London predominantly. Technology companies are just fundamentally very different. And you just, again, the DNA from the get-go of the founding team, of the early investors, is significantly different. If you look into, and so you have usually technology companies start in technology hubs. And so would be, you know, obviously Silicon Valley, you see Tel Aviv. Sometimes kind of you see that overlap or merge between the technology and publishing. But for the most part, these are two separate worlds. And even now, even today, if you step into our office in Tel Aviv, it has a very different vibe than the energy you will feel in the offices in the media hubs of New York and London.
So do you run your tech out of Tel Aviv and then the journalism in other places?
Exactly. So the tech is exclusively out of the Tel Aviv office. We have about 70 plus predominantly tech team out of Tel Aviv. And then the publishing side of the business, which is content and ad sales, is in New York, in London, and in other global media hubs such as, you know, Tokyo, Sao Paulo, LA. Yeah.
So in a sense, that global idea that you, I guess, originally ran from Tel Aviv, you've now kind of expanded out into these other markets that you're serving, like the NFL and the baseball and whatever is being, I guess, is being done from the States, and then maybe football is being done more from Europe.
Sure. So fortunately for us, we have established a global foundation from early on. And football is a very natural sport, or soccer, when we present it in the US, it's a very natural sport. So 90min is a very global brand. Again, it's quite substantial in the major football markets in Asia and in Latin America and in Europe. However, 12UP, the American sports brand, is US only. So it's more domestic. Esports, on the other end, is also a very global phenomena. Yeah. So we also take it into more and more markets.
Right. So I was looking at your numbers recently. You've had revenue growth that most publishers would kill for. You know, I guess you had revenue growth last year of about 100%. Is that right?
So this year in 2019, we're growing our revenue by over 120% year over year. So, you know, cannot maybe really share the exact numbers as a private company, but you may assume that it's quite substantial. So yeah. I would say converging to call it three digits in terms of millions of dollars of annual revenue.
I guess our listeners are probably less interested in your actual numbers than they are in how the hell you did it. Can you talk about that? Can you talk about your growth strategy? Because I know you've got organic growth, but you've also got acquisitions.
So I would say, the fact that we have built a centralized technology platform that allows us to venture into new content categories quite easily, and then into new markets and languages quite easily, and then allows us to, using the same technology platform, to build our B2C brands, but also our B2B2C integrated partnerships. I think that diversity enabled by the technology platform really, I would say, allows us to grow more easily than, say, a single site business, right, or so a single vertical business.
If you were going to break down your revenue roughly, how much comes from sales of technology? How much comes directly from like publishing revenues, of advertising, sponsorship? And then I guess there's a last category there that maybe is about content creation for brands, branded content.
So the way we break down the revenue, it's a great question. The way we break down the revenue is into the two major lines of business. One is advertising generated on our O&O brands, like 90min and 12UP and DoubleTap. Yeah. And then the other line of revenue is generated by our publishing partners using our platform. You may assume that the second part, the platform-driven side of the business, is now more than 50% of the revenue. Mm-hmm. When it comes to the advertising side, we monetize programmatically, we monetize direct, and we monetize video. So there are different forms of advertising.
In terms of how those things all work together, you know, so would you sell advertising on sites that you're selling the technology platform to?
Great question, and the answer is yes. So when we started, we were focusing on licensing, so you could license our product and content. Now it's a combination. You can either license, or you can also ask us to monetize for you, so then we would sell advertising against some of the sites that use our platform.
Do you see the business changing, or even, I mean, it's a weird question maybe, but do you see the business splitting in two, so that one would actually be the service business? A platform business, and the other one's a publishing business?
Yeah. So when we started extending the business into the kind of the B2B, the platform side, we were thinking of separate siloed approach to the two lines of business. But over the last couple of years, we actually took the opposite approach of consolidating everything. We believe that the driver of our business is the economies of scale of using a single technology platform for the two lines of business, of using a single tech team to serve the two lines of business, to have a single global sales team selling across the two lines of business. So we believe that it's the consolidated approach that drives our scale, not the other way around.
Do you think doing both sides makes you smarter?
We think so. We think that being a publisher, a large-scale publisher ourselves, provides us with the insights, the experience that allows us to provide a better service and platform and technology and content for our partners. And then serving a greater number of partners over time does provide us with very interesting insights and experiences that help us improve our offering on our own and operated brands.
So I know one of the acquisitions you've made is Mental Floss, which I loved Mental Floss back in the day. I used to fly to the States, probably almost 10 years ago. I would fly at least once a month, and I always tried to buy Mental Floss in print, and I absolutely loved it.
Really?
And I still look at it online, but I'm just wondering, okay, so one of the things is, why did you buy it? Why was that an acquisition that you thought was interesting for you? And the other question, I guess, around Mental Floss is that, because it's not in print any longer, but is that affinity that was there with print, has it come to digital? You still have that?
Yeah. So about a year ago, we decided to start looking for acquisitions. And the reason is that, we believed we have reached a certain scale that allowed us to look to kind of add to our team. We thought that our technology platform was flexible enough and robust enough to be able to digest other publishers into it. And we thought that we have built a global infrastructure across all publishing functions to be able to take a brand such as Mental Floss to the next level. The reason we picked Mental Floss as our first acquisition was we've been looking hard. We have examined dozens of potential targets. And it's actually the opinion of like avid fans like yourself. Like, we're really passionate about the brand and the content for over 15 years now. It's over 10 million unique users digitally, to your question, that come to the site every month, that prove to us the potential, the great quality of the content, the great engagement with advertisers. And Mental Floss is our first non-sports publishing play, and we have been witnessing more and more demand from our advertising partner to diversify our audience more into female and other content categories. And we thought it's quite complementary from a coverage standpoint, and so it's those are the reasons behind picking Mental Floss as the first acquisition. And again, it's been very successful and provided us with the appetite to go and look for similar great acquisition targets.
So are you looking? Are you looking for more acquisitions in the future?
Yes, so we have acquired, following the success of Mental Floss, we've acquired a second publisher, another kind of very successful play for us, a company called The Big Lead, an American sports publisher focusing on the business side of sports, which we have acquired from the USA Today, from Gannett. Also super happy with this one. And the answer is yes, we're about to announce our third acquisition within the next couple of months, and expect to continue to acquire at least 3 to 4 additional top-notch publishers next year in 2020.
I mean, I guess, look, going back to Mental Floss, I guess what's interesting is that fan mentality. You know, the idea that I loved Mental Floss because I'm a fact geek, and that's what Mental Floss is all about. And I guess a lot of sports fans, they love their stats, they love the information that's involved in sports publishing.
Yes,
is that something that sort of underplays what you're looking for in an acquisition?
Yeah, I would say we're looking for a significant passion of an audience for a content category. So we would be less interested in content that reflects less engagement with its user base. And when the engagement is there, we believe that that's where we can best exploit the products that we have built and the experiences that we enable, where the passion for the content is there.
And is Mental Floss doing okay, digital only?
So fortunately, the answer is yes. It's doing really well digitally. It's growing substantially within Minute Media. As I said, it's over 10 or even 12 million unique users a month. Everything is growing, the organic usage, the content, the engagement, also the revenue. In fact, funny enough, over the last couple of quarters, we have seen demand from print businesses to consider doing stuff again with Mental Floss. We have seen a lot of demand on the podcast front to do stuff with Mental Floss. So we think the brand is very robust, has great credibility, and so we do expect to see it extending into new forms of media beyond just pure text digital or video digital that's been the focus for us so far.
Oh, excellent. I'm a fan. I'll be there.
Yeah, thank you.
One of the things I think, you know, I'm asking that question about mental floss, but digital media was once, I guess it was seen as being invincible, but a bunch of players have had tough times recently, and, you know, I'm thinking from Vice, R29 deal recently, looked like a survival play rather than a strong deal with two brands coming together to grow. What do you think? What do you think the future for digital media looks like?
Yeah. We tend to agree. So if you look at into the digital media landscape over the past decade, it's the emergence of social and predominantly Facebook about 8-9 years ago as a form of driving content usage that has caused a significant fragmentation of the market. So Facebook diverting millions of users into new sites has enabled a old generation of new social publishers. And again, Vice, BuzzFeed, there's just a couple of examples. There are dozens of other examples. But then what happened in early 2018 is that the Facebook feed has become so populated with so much content, including fake news and other forms of negative content, call it. And Facebook made a conscious decision to lower the amount of content populating users' feed. And that decision by Facebook has significantly reduced the level of social traffic flowing into all that those new publishers and severely affected many of them. So it's really Facebook that has enabled so many new publishers and then unfortunately diminished and really hurt many of them over the last couple of years. So our belief always has been that, yes, we should also work with the social platforms, but we should build our business on our own technology platform. And so therefore, last year when Facebook and other social platforms have started changing the way they interact with content sites, we were not as affected and we could continue to grow at a time where other publishers have been really suffering. So that's the way we see the market. It's fragmented over the last decade because of social media, and probably over the next couple of years, what we're going to see is consolidation again when it comes to content sites. You'll see that the bigger players survive and thrive and scale, and the smaller ones struggle to stand alone.
Well, that's definitely what went on with Vice and Refinery 29. Do you think a sort of niche approach that is kind of at the heart of what you're doing is important?
Yes, so I would say that. So no doubt that probably focusing and going all in and deepening into a vertical or niche is probably a better approach than a broad across the board general one. However, again, because we believe that nowadays, because of the challenges faced by, you know, social platforms or caused by social platforms, you also, as a publisher, want to gain scale. So if you do focus on a niche, it still has to be substantial enough in terms of size. And so that's why, you know, football, you can call it like a vertical niche, but it's big enough for you to be able to gain the scale required nowadays to thrive in publishing.
So our final question that we ask every guest is just to recommend a single piece of media that you've loved recently. So what would you suggest to our listeners?
Yeah, so I am biased. I'm a very big sports fan. So I and just to be fair, quite late, I kind of joined the party quite late, but I'm quite big into podcasting. So to me, over the last couple of years, combining my passion for sports and more podcasting, I would say The Ringer in sports is just a great great podcast. So that would be one of my key kind of the recommendations out there.
Okay, this is your regular reminder that we have an email newsletter. Just go to our website, put your email address in the little box, and we'll send you a newsletter every Wednesday. It's lovely, do it.
And that website is voices.media. It breaks out all our episodes by, you know, strategy, analysis. It breaks them out by, you know, conversations episodes versus the regular episodes. So you can get to that by going to voices.media. Otherwise, you can follow us on Twitter at Media Voices Pod.
And we say this every week, but the Publisher Podcast Awards are open for less than 3 weeks by the time you're listening to this. So make sure you've got your entry pack by going to publisherpodcastawards.com, or you can follow us for updates on PubPod Awards on Twitter.
But until next week, when we're going to be back with another reminder that you only have a fortnight to get your entries in, thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.
Stop Brexit.
There you go.